Hey, All Sides listeners, I'm Steve Brown, the co-host of WOSU's new political podcast, Snollygoster. Every week, we'll talk to newsmakers, reporters, and lots of other smart people to get the latest on politics from around Columbus and the rest of the state. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control has recommended daily exercise for all Americans, and their most recent reports show that most of us meet the recommended amount, but most Americans stop working out regularly after about 3 months. So for many, just taking the steps to start exercising is half the battle. It's all about the way you structure your fitness routine, according to best-selling author and the New York Times reporter covering health, fitness, nutrition and epidemiology, Anahad O'Connor. Anahad recently wrote about how to start working out for the Times. We'll post a link to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Is this just an American thing, struggling to stay committed to working out?
No, this is something that cuts across populations and cultures. It's a, I'd say, pretty international thing because exercise is inherently discomforting for a lot of people. So a lot of people make a resolution to start, and then unfortunately, most people stop working out within about less than 6 months of starting a new exercise plan.
The idea of quote-unquote physical fitness and exercise and that kind of a thing, it's a relatively new thing in our culture, right?
Yeah, I'd say it really started to pick up decades ago. You know, the running culture in America started decades ago with Jim Fix, who kind of got us hooked on the idea of running and doing marathons. In many cultures around the world, you know, traditionally, exercise and physical activity are just kind of built into the day, where people go out and, you know, walk to town, or they work, you know, as farmers and things like that. Here in America and a lot of other societies, obviously, we tend to sit in front of computers in cubicles much of the day.
How much exercise are we supposed to get? What are we talking about here?
So the federal government recommends about 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise, or about 75 minutes a week of vigorous, high-intensity exercise, or some combination of the two. But you should be exercising at least a few days a week.
And does it change depending on your age?
Yeah, so it changes depending on your age, depending on your physical capabilities. You know, obviously younger people are going to be able to do a lot more, but that, you know, shouldn't stop older people who are maybe, you know, more physically limited from just getting out and walking and moving around. And in fact, there are many studies showing that, you know, just walking a few minutes a day can have a significant impact on your lifespan.
It can. I guess a lot of this boils down to, and you write about it, about what you're shooting for. What are your goals, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing I tried to do in the story is, you know, address the fact that we all know that exercise is good for us. You know, there are a million studies, you know, showing the many benefits of exercise, from its impact on reducing heart disease, which is the number one killer of not only Americans, but people across the globe, you know, reducing obesity, extending your lifespan, impacting your happiness. Exercise makes people generally happier, studies show. So we all know that there are plenty of reasons to exercise, but a lot of people simply don't do it. And it's not because of the lack of awareness. It's because oftentimes most of us don't have the right tools or techniques to actually create a fitness plan and then stick to it.
And part of one of those tools is knowing what your goals are in the first place.
Absolutely. So, you know, what we found in research is that you should first and foremost understand your why. So, you know, if you're exercising because you want to lose a certain amount of weight, that's something you need to sort of keep in the back of your mind and remind yourself of that during your exercise program, because there are going to be times when you want to stop. Or if your goal is simply to be healthier, you know, to lower your risk of heart disease because it runs in your family, that's something you need to keep in the back of your mind. And really understand your core motivation, because it's going to keep you, it's going to be one of the many things that can keep you from stopping your program. And then there's also a list of other things that, people should do.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Anahat O'Connor, reporter for The New York Times. He covers health, fitness, nutrition, and epidemiology. And we're talking about the importance of exercise and how to stick to an exercise program. You know, a lot of times when we're talking about diet on the program, Anahat, we're talking about stop thinking of diet as something that you're going to go through for 3 months and lose a certain amount of weight, that it's a lifestyle thing. Don't think of exercise as something that you're going to achieve something with and then stop.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, people need to really look at exercise, you know, as you said, as incorporating it into a lifestyle, making it a part of your routine. And that's one of the ways that people can actually stick with a plan, is to schedule exercise, you know, into your life like you would anything else. You know, if you, know you have to pick up the kids, twice a week, you put that on your calendar. If you know you have to go shopping, you know, at a certain time of the week, you put that on your calendar. You should also put exercise on your calendar so that you, stick to it. You set reminders until it becomes an ingrained habit.
How long does that take?
It varies person to person, but it could be anywhere from weeks to a couple months. And I'd say, some of the really important things that studies have found help people really stick to an exercise plan is, first and foremost, setting short-term goals. You know, a lot of people, start an exercise plan and say, I want to lose 20 pounds or I want to lose 30 pounds. And those are very lofty goals. You really want to start off with shorter term, smaller goals, like I want to lose 5 pounds, or better yet, just saying, I want to exercise 3 days a week. And, you may set a plan Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and you may miss one day, but, if you miss Wednesday and then exercise Thursday and Friday, that's fine. But the idea is to set really short term, attainable, realistic goals.
But knowing why you want, say weight loss is part of what you're shooting for, that helps you decide what you're going to do when it comes to exercise, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You can say your primary motivation is for weight loss. You want to be healthier, you want to look better, and that's totally fine. But your goal shouldn't be to say, I want to lose exactly 20 pounds, mm-hmm. and I'm going to do that in 2 months, and once I get there, I'll be fine. Your goal should be, okay, I want to lose, a certain amount of weight, and to do that, I know I have to exercise because that's going to help me. So I'm going to exercise 3 days a week.
Some exercises are better than others. I mean, there's the, 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, the interval training, that kind of a thing, that are better for what you're shooting for.
Well, I wouldn't say necessarily better. I would say more efficient.
Okay.
So you're talking about high intensity interval training, which is a very efficient way of exercising. And it's particularly great for people who have, limited time. So we often think of going to the gym, for an hour or 45 minutes, and that's, part of a daily workout. But for people who are busier, have limited time, you can do, a 20-minute or even 10-minute workout, which, we link to in the article. We have all sorts of exercise plans for people there, even a 1-minute workout for the days where, you're crunched and you're swamped. And the upside is that because it's so efficient, you get all the benefits that you would out of a 45-minute workout if your intensity is high enough. So there's really no excuse when it comes to, how much time you have. You can do a 10-minute workout that's will give you most of the benefits that you'll get out of a 45-minute workout, because most of the benefits come in the beginning of the workout.
Knowing yourself is an important thing. Knowing that, for instance, you're motivated by working out with other people, and acknowledging that and tapping into that, right?
Absolutely. So that's one of the tools that people can use, is tapping their social network, because studies have actually shown that if you set a plan to work out with a friend tomorrow morning, then you're more likely to actually, show up, because you don't want to let down your friend, versus, if you set a plan to exercise at, 6:30 in the morning, you wake up at, 6:20, you might feel tired and say, I'm just going to go back to sleep. But if you know that someone is out there counting on you to show up, then you're more likely to do it. And, your workout partner can motivate you, send you text messages, and vice versa. So working out with a friend is a big one, you know, a friend or a spouse or a partner, colleague, setting those short-term goals, being realistic. Also, you know, one thing people tend to overlook is the idea of setting process goals over outcome goals. Mm. So let's say you want to start running. Instead of saying, you know, I want to be able to run 10 miles in a certain amount of time, you should say to yourself, you know, I want to be able to, you know, run for 30 minutes 3 days a week. And then as you get better and better at running, you say, okay, I'm going to run for 45 minutes, and then I'm going to run for an hour. So focus on the process over the very specific goals, because focusing on the process, it's much easier to accomplish that than, you know, let's say you run 9 miles and you fall short of 10, you might get discouraged.
How do you know what to do at the gym when you go? If you're going by yourself, you're going to the gym, you need to set goals. Should you just kind of shoot for the stuff that you like doing, or what's the approach there?
Yeah, so there's a few things here. I would say, you know, there's that famous quote, you know, those who fail to plan, plan to fail. You definitely don't want to go to the gym without some idea of what you're going to do, because if you're just walking around sort of unsure, you're most likely not going to get a great workout. So in the article that I wrote, we actually link to a lot of different exercise plans that you can use at the gym, and you should always go in with some kind of plan. You know, for some people, let's say you want to start strength training, because that's extremely important for health, and most people don't do nearly enough resistance training. You can maybe plan, you can use the exercises that we provide in the article, or you can, you know, set up a couple sessions with a personal trainer just to show you some of the resistance training techniques. But yes, you should definitely go in with a plan.
You talk about retraining our brain to keep up a regular workout. What does that involve?
Yeah, so a lot of people, you know, when they start working out, it may be going great at first, but then you will always have those moments where, you know you have to go to a 5:30 p.m., you know, gym class after work, and there's a voice in your head that's going to, you know, chime in and say, oh, let's just, you know, forget about this today. It's been a long day. Let's just go home and sit on the TV and watch Netflix. And it's really important to stick to your plan by conquering these sort of voices or these inner demons. And you can do that through a process called cognitive restructuring, and it's really just taking control of this internal dialogue. And one of the techniques for doing that was developed by a psychologist named Jim Annesi. And so what you do when you hear this voice telling you to not work out is, as soon as you hear it, you immediately squelch it by yelling stop inside your head. This is all internal, so you yell stop to try to take control of this this inner voice. And then you remind yourself, you sort of reaffirm the reasons you exercise. So you yell stop as loud as you can internally. And then you tell yourself, once I get started exercising, I feel energized. Or you can say things like, exercise is one of the best things I can do for myself, so I have to stay consistent. So you stop this voice that's trying to discourage you. And then you repeat sort of a mantra that reaffirms why you're exercising. And it's actually been shown to be very effective in studies.
You write about dissociation as well.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of people, you know, they say, okay, I want to go to the gym and use the treadmill. And then they're on the treadmill or their Stairmaster, and they're exercising. And you see that little clock there telling you you've only burned 30 calories and you've only been exercising 10 minutes or something like that. What you want to do is try to remove yourself from these, you know, sort of things that are reminding you about the discomforting feeling of exercise. So you can put a towel over the screen on the treadmill, or what you can do is, you know, put one of your favorite programs on the TV screen, and that sort of dissociates you from, you know, what you're doing in the moment. Or better yet, you know, if you want to run, go in the park and run, and then you're focusing more on the external environment and the nice things you're seeing in the park. Rather than use a stationary bike, for example, if you can, get on a bike and cycle outside in a park, because then you're seeing, you know, the lovely surroundings and the scenery, and it can help sort of separate you from, you know, the task at hand. And I think that's something that's very important, because you know, as I said earlier, exercise is, you know, inherently uncomfortable for a lot of people, and that's one of the reasons that people stop it. So if you can find ways to dissociate during the exercise by, you know, being outside, people watching, you know, looking at the surroundings or watching your favorite program while you're on the treadmill or listening to a podcast or NPR, you know, those are ways to help yourself remove or maybe not focus so much on the discomforting feelings.
One thing I don't see a lot of, I did have a great boot camp teacher one time who periodically had us play games. You know, we would play, you know, whatever the game might have been. And it was, it got us moving, and it was always something that was strenuous. But she had all different kinds of goofy games she would have us play, and we weren't thinking about working out. And I don't think a lot of people do that very often. They're like, if they're into basketball, they're into basketball, and never will you ever break into basketball, you know, after a certain period of time in your life. What about playing games? That's a different kind of exercise.
Yeah, you nailed it right on the head. And that's also a part of dissociating. You know, if you're goal is to do a cardio workout and, you know, you're standing there, you know, running on the treadmill or you're running up a path, you know, you're focused on the running. But if you're doing the running as part of this game, maybe it's part of kickball or basketball, you're running up and down the court, but it doesn't feel as much as exercise because, as you said, you're playing a game and you're having fun. So that's important for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's helping you to dissociate and to separate yourself from, you know, the discomforting feelings of doing a high-intensity exercise. But number two is that they've actually shown in studies, you know, when they look at people who are doing, you know, an exercise plan, and after 6 months they look at the people who stopped and they look at the people who are continuing with their workout plan, and they try to find the reasons, you know, why certain people continued and others stopped. The number one reason they found was that the people who are actually enjoying their workouts, those are the people who are most likely to be doing the workouts 6 months later versus the people who say, I want to do exercise because I want to lose a lot of weight, so I'm going to go find the toughest, hardest exercise that I can find. And it may help them at first lose some weight or, you know, feel better or get in shape, but if they're not enjoying it, they're much less likely to keep doing it. So if you find something that can help you dissociate, you know, if you're not a big fan of exercise, and you find something that you enjoy, that's far more important than, you know, focusing on the number of calories you're burning or the type of exercise. You just want to do something that's that you can do for the long haul that you enjoy. That's really the best reasons to stick to a plan.
Anahat O'Connor, thanks for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
Anahat O'Connor is a best-selling author and a reporter for the New York Times. He covers health, fitness, nutrition, and epidemiology. He wrote about starting out a workout for the Times. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Cancer is a physical and emotional journey. Good medicine coupled with kindness matters. According to a recent review of the evidence at Stanford University, Leonard Berry, a senior fellow with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement at Texas A&M University, is co-author of a report about the six types of kindness that can improve cancer care. He wrote about the topic for the Washington Post. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Leonard Berry joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ann.
We, you know, often refer to this as sort of a bedside manner issue, something considered a weakness in many doctors. You wrote that the stressors of modern medicine often interfere with good intentions. How so?
Well, medical care in general and cancer care in particular, and has become so complex, so technical, and so pressurized for the clinicians, and even though kindness makes so much sense intuitively, we know it's important. The complexities and pressures of modern medicine get in the way. And so we wrote our article, my colleagues and I, to not only remind clinicians in cancer care of the importance of kindness, but also to break out the concept of kindness into six different dimensions or types of kindness. And it's important. Ask any cancer patient, anyone who's gone through the emotional turmoil of a cancer diagnosis, and they will document, as they have to me in many, many interviews I've done with cancer patients.
What do we mean by kindness in this context?
We mean taking the time to truly listen to the patient and to family that support the patient. We mean truly being empathetic, finding your way into your patient's shoes, understanding the situation in which they find themselves so that you can help them better. We mean by kindness, generosity, extra effort. We mean timeliness, a timely care. There's so much waiting in receiving cancer treatment, cancer care, and waiting is suffering. Patients that are waiting to hear a test result, they're waiting for an appointment, is suffering. We mean by kindness, gentle honesty. Most patients want to hear the truth. There's a good deal of research that documents that. But the truth needs to be told in the way that works for the patient, in using gentle words, kind words, well-chosen words. And finally, kindness means kindness not only to the patient but to the family caregivers, because so much cancer care is informal care given at the home.
How did you come up with these six kinds of kindness?
And I've for the last 4 years, I've focused on cancer care, the service part of cancer care, and I've worked with a number of oncologists and have done a number of field visits to some of our leading cancer centers in America and abroad, and have interviewed many cancer patients as well as the clinicians that care for them. And it's a result of that work.
Is there evidence that this actually has an effect on someone's well-being? Or is it just about emotionally as you're going through the process of treating cancer or living with cancer or dying from cancer, it just feels better?
Yes, that's a great question, and that's the question I would ask first if I was reading my article or listening to this broadcast. Kindness in clinical care is very important because of the stress and anxiety and fear that patients are feeling. But it's also important in terms of the actual outcomes. Kindness is not, I want to be very clear on this, it's not a substitute for chemotherapy or radiation or surgery when needed, when indicated. It's not a substitute, but good clinical care plus kindness is the best possible care that can be delivered. And, you know, take, for example, Anne, in terms of your question, does it matter beyond the emotions of the patient? Take, for example, the first type of kindness that we write about in our article, which is deep listening, taking the time to really listen, taking the time to understand what matters to the patient, not only what's the matter, but what matters to the patient. And unhurried listening can be the anecdote to providing undesired treatment. I mean, if physicians listen well and truly understand their patients, they're less likely to provide treatment that the patients don't want. They're less likely to miss information that's pertinent to the treatment plan. And they're less likely to basically provide care that's not in the best interest of the patient. And so that's one example. I could go through all six of the dimensions of kindness that I listed a moment ago and give you examples of how it can possibly affect the physical outcome, not just the emotional outcome.
Empathy is key. You wrote about the four essential attributes of empathy. Tell us about those in terms of your work here.
Well, let me give you first. I'll mention the four attributes, and they come from a nursing scholar, Teresa Wiseman, who we cite in our writing. And those four attributes of empathy are seeing the world from somebody else's perspective, avoiding judgment when assessing a situation, recognizing the emotion present and responding to that emotion in a genuinely caring way. Those are the four aspects of empathy. And we really liked Teresa Wiseman's framework, which is why we used it in our work. Let me give you an example of empathy, your listeners, an example that we put in our article. It's not in the short form article that's in the Washington Post, but that the Washington Post article is a result of a longer article that we published in an oncology journal, in a medical journal, read by clinicians. Mm-hmm. And the example I'm going to share with you is one I really love. It illustrates empathy. And it comes from Australia. There's a radiation center called the Peter MacCallum Radiation Center in Australia. And one of the parents, they take care of pediatric cancer patients, and one of the parents that we interviewed said this: "My son had general anesthesia for radiation therapy, but as he felt a lot of anxiety about this procedure, the team would allow him to sit on me, on my lap, during anesthesia. They also noticed that when he woke up, he got upset about lacking a shirt. Now the team puts his shirt back on before he wakes. To me, these small acts were ultimate kindnesses, reducing his anxiety and distress, and therefore my own." That's empathy. That's empathy. Those small acts, but they meant so much to the child receiving treatment and to his mother.
Let's hear from Fritz in Hebron. Fritz, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to say I just completed 5 chemo treatments and 35 radiation treatments at James. Mm-hmm. And one exception, but everyone there treated me like I was their only patient that day. All the doctors took whatever time I needed, because there was a time when I was down. I'll just say that I was really down. Mm-hmm. They took time to listen, and what you're saying is absolutely correct from a patient standpoint.
It mattered.
It mattered.
How are you doing now?
Last time they looked at me, they couldn't see the cancer. And I'll get a PET scan done in May that will be the definitive answer, from what I understand.
Well, best wishes for, all the luck in the world on that score, Fritz. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. I just wanted to reinforce what the doctor was saying. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Take care. What are doctors and other, what are they starting to learn? I mean, are they starting to teach about this in medical school that someone like Fritz, I mean, he can feel better while he waits the results? He feels better already, he thinks.
Yes, I'm really glad that Fritz came on the show, and I appreciate his comments so much. I've interviewed so many patients like Fritz, some who've had outcomes that are not as as satisfying in terms of their treatment or the way they were made to feel, mm-hmm. as Fritz was. But what Fritz told us in his comments ring true to me based on the research I've done over the last 4 years with cancer patients. Yes, to answer your question, Anne, more and more health systems and cancer centers are starting to teach these ideas. For example, at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit, Michigan, mm-hmm. Oncology fellows are trained in empathetic communication. They're trained by actors who play the roles of patients and family members. And this situational teaching shows physicians how to decode certain kinds of behaviors as emotional clues and practice responding empathetically. I'm close friends with the head of this particular program at Henry Ford, and she tells me that this has been very successful, very well received by the physicians.
And as far as medical school goes, is this something that's on the curriculum or what?
Not as much as it should be. That's one of the passions that I have is to, in my writings, because I write a lot about improving the service experience of patients in cancer, but also in other illnesses, other illness contexts, in the medical journals, trying to reach the people that are running the medical schools. The progressive medical schools, the more innovative medical schools, and in some cases the newer medical schools, are the most innovative and progressive in terms of teaching the service side of healthcare.
You know, we heard from Fritz. He was at the James here at Ohio State University. Are we at the whim of whoever we happen to get as a physician or a nurse or whoever is going to be part of our treatment when we have cancer? You know, you really aren't interviewing them in the first place. You're usually just trying to find somebody, you know, who'll take on your case and do what you think, but you don't really talk about the issue of kindness with them, or could you as a patient?
Well, yeah, it's a very real issue that you've raised, Anne, and an important one, and a difficult one, a challenging one for the patient, because here the patient has the scariest diagnosis of his or her life. Cancer is such a frightening disease. It's a life-changing disease. It may not be life-ending, but it is life-changing. There's not one patient I've interviewed who would disagree with what I've just said. It changes your life. Fritz, who's completed his treatments and everything looks good, he's going to be nervous when he goes for his next scan, his next checkup, just like every other cancer patient who's post-treatment. So the patient isn't, with a brand-new cancer diagnosis or suspicion of cancer, isn't in the best position to start interviewing the doctor. Mm-hmm. The patient is generally very fortunate to get an appointment with an oncologist or a surgeon to proceed in what needs to be done. But in fact, the choice of who cares for you for serious disease like cancer is about the most important consumer choice we make as people. And to the degree that we can find the right source of care and ask a few questions that we might not be comfortable asking before we decide, mm-hmm. is to our benefit.
Leonard Berry, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
You are most welcome. thank you for your kindness in having me on your show, Ann.
Leonard Berry is a senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement in Cambridge, Massachusetts. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. An estimated 10 to 20% of Americans suffer from stomach ailments linked to irritable bowel syndrome. Commonly known as IBS, it can significantly affect work and your quality of life. The March issue of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter covers that and many other topics. Joining us by phone is chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be with you.
Irritable bowel syndrome just sounds bad. there's just nothing about that sounds good. What is it?
Well, there is something about it that is good, and that is that it is not inflammatory bowel disease.
Okay.
By that, I mean it's a disease that there's no clear-cut pathology. It doesn't lead to long-term other complications outside of the bowel. So it's not a life-threatening disease, but it certainly can be a life-altering disease. And by that, I mean it can really make people's lives very uncomfortable and disruptive. A very common disease, as you mentioned. The interesting thing is, although it's one of the most common reasons people will come to their doctor for gastrointestinal problems, mm-hmm. we have no idea what causes it.
What are the symptoms?
Well, the symptoms can vary. They can either primarily be constipation, or they can primarily be diarrhea, or very commonly a combination of those two, and often a lot of bloating and cramping in the abdomen, lots of gassy feeling. So it's quite disruptive to a person's life.
And we don't know what causes it.
We have ideas.
Okay.
If you look at the bowel under the microscope, you don't see anything abnormal at all. So for years, when I was in medical school, we were taught this is just a nervous stomach, and it's probably due to psychological issues. People are just too stressed, and that's why they're getting it. Medicine's moved a long way away from that since then. And clearly there's something wrong, but there's nothing wrong that you can see. So there are ideas. One of the most interesting ones is that it may have something to do with an alteration in the bacteria and other organisms that live in our gut. And that may be a trigger for it. We call this sort of the brain-gut axis, where what's going on in our gut with the organisms there can perhaps influence how our brain is telling our gut to work. So that's a really exciting hypothesis at this point. Other things have to do with neurotransmitter problems, hormonal problems, genetics. So there's lots of ideas, but again, we haven't hammered down what the cause is or what the causes are.
So how do you treat it then?
Well, there's lots of ways to treat it. The first thing is people tend to either have the predominant symptom being the constipation, or they tend to have the predominant symptoms being the diarrhea. With it. So depending upon which of those two you have, to a large extent determines how it's treated. For the diarrheal problem, there are several drugs that have been approved in the last 10 to 15 years that have been clinically shown to decrease symptomatology and make people much more comfortable. There is a caveat. These are pharmaceutical agents, and some of them have very significant complications, so you don't want to glibly just go and take these drugs. For the constipation side of the equation, people have advocated more use of fiber, more use of fluids, increased physical activity. Those things tend to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
There are drugs also for the constipation side of it. Again, with the same caveat that some drugs have serious side effects, and so you don't just go ahead and say, "Doctor, please prescribe me a pill."
Mm-hmm.
One of the more interesting avenues of approach has been to manipulate the organisms that live in our colon with specific kinds of probiotics. There's not been a lot of research done yet on this, but some of the preliminary research suggests that certain probiotics, not the ones you just go into the drugstore and buy, or that some health food store tells you, oh, this will work fine. There's specific ones that your doctor would advise you about that might be very helpful, for either side of the equation, or commonly for what we call a mixed problem of both the constipation and diarrhea.
And they won't hurt?
We don't think so. There's in an otherwise healthy person, probiotics appear to be safe. If you're immunosuppressed, if you've got cancer, then I think we're not as confident as to how safe they are, and there have been some rare complications with them.
When you talk about probiotics, are you talking about the kombucha kind of drinks, those kind of things, or?
Well, they haven't been well studied.
Okay.
That said, kefir, or yogurts that have active cultures in them,
mm-hmm.
there are reports suggesting that for some people they do help, and certainly we don't think there's any risk in consuming those. So that's worth looking at for people with irritable bowel syndrome. Another thing that's maybe worth doing is really significantly manipulating your diet. There's been some very interesting research originally coming out of Australia, but now reports in good scientific journals and other places where by altering your diet to avoid certain foods, we call this the FODMAP diet, FODMAP, and by eliminating certain foods that we think can trigger particularly the bloating symptoms, people have had pretty good responses to that. Now, I'm not suggesting that people should just go and Google FODMAP and find the diet and buy the foods and go on that diet. Not at all. This is a decision that should be made with your physician, perhaps preferably a gastroenterologist,
mm-hmm.
and probably in consultation also with a dietitian. Because these very restrictive diets, long-term, we don't know what the consequences are. On the other hand, if someone's life is just terribly disrupted by IBS, it may be worth a try. And at least in the short term, we don't know of any dire consequences from that.
And IBS, as far as that goes, is it something that develops later in life? Is it something people have most of their life? I remember I had my best friend from college, they said she had a nervous stomach. So I know that going back into the olden days, you know, that's what they were telling her she had, you know, as a freshman in college. Is there any kind of way to look at it that way?
Yeah, it can occur at any time in life, but
okay.
It is more common in females than males.
Huh.
It tends to occur commonly in the teens, particularly later teens, but it can occur earlier than that, and even preteens, but it can occur any time in life.
There's another article about microalgae, pond scum, or superfood is the headline, and there's certainly a lot of algae in, you know, some of the Great Lakes these days. What are we talking about here? Is this actually something that you could eat? Because we hear a lot about the toxic algae.
Right. This is one of the marketers' new superfoods. It's algae that tends to form, such as seaweed and kelp, and it's added to foods like lattes, smoothies, and even cookies and chips. And, of course, like all marketing, they're touted as virtual cure-alls for heart disease, gastrointestinal problems, dementia, and it just goes, the list goes on and on and on. To the best of our knowledge, these are perfectly safe. There's no toxicity from these as opposed to the algae that you're referring to at all. And they do contain some vitamin C, some vitamin K, some beta carotene, just like a lot of vegetables do. They're good sources of vitamin B12. So they do have nutritional qualities, but frankly, the bottom line is they're a food. They're healthy. They're no more healthy than other healthy foods you can get at the grocery store. And don't believe all the hype on that.
There just haven't been the studies done, right?
There haven't been the studies done. And frankly, when we looked at what microalgae is composed of, we didn't find anything that special about it.
Wellness coaches. That's a big thing, a growing thing. What is a wellness coach, first of all?
Well, it's anybody who wants to call themselves a wellness coach can call themselves that. So it's a little hard to pin down. That said, in an attempt to professionalize wellness coaches because they are so popular, in 2017, a certification examination and criteria were put together. So a certified wellness coach is somebody who's gone through specific education, has gone through adequate training. So they will call themselves a wellness coach, and they rightfully should, because they're licensed to, or they're at least they're certified to do that. That said, I think people have to recognize that there are some caveats to wellness coaches. They can be very helpful in terms of encouraging people to exercise, to eat well, to do the healthy things in their lives. And there's some studies. There was a good one in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings about 3 years ago that showed that wellness coaching can improve mood, perceived stress, and quality of life. So there is some data to suggest they're very helpful. I think it's worth people pursuing. The caveat about it is that, again, anybody can call themselves a wellness coach, and you have to be careful that these are not nutritionists, they're not registered dietitians, they're not physicians, they're not physical therapists, they certainly are not experts in supplements. So those are the types of advice that you don't get from a wellness coach, you should not get from a wellness coach. On the other hand, these folks can, as I said, be very helpful in terms of getting people to do the things that we know will improve the quality and quantity of their life.
So they're like motivational people.
Exactly, exactly. And they do it well. Well-trained people in this area, certified people, that's what your listeners need to make sure that these folks are certified. Certified people can really be helpful in getting you to stick with it.
Well, we were talking about getting the right exercise, and one of the hardest things is to stick with it. And if you can afford it, a wellness coach might help motivate you to stick to something like that, or a
absolutely.
Diet.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, the gym I go to, it is always so crowded in January.
Mm-hmm.
And then by February, it's not nearly as crowded, and now it's not crowded at all. And that's the pattern every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody makes the January 1st, the New Year's resolution.
You can't get a parking spot.
Yep, you got it.
We only have about a minute or so left, Dr. Swartzberg, but I did want to talk about the shingles vaccine. Apparently, it's new and approved, but shingles is just as bad as ever, right?
Yeah, but the bottom line to this is get it.
Yeah.
The old shingles vaccine that I got, it is helpful. It decreases the chance of getting shingles by modestly, maybe about 50%. This new one, the data shows that in the first year, it's in the high 90% area of preventing shingles. So get it.
Get the shingles vaccine.
Absolutely.
Dr. Swartzberg, thanks as always. You're nice to have you back, and thanks for your time today.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks for listening today. This has been Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.